This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we revisit interviews from earlier this year on baseball and politics. Coming up, author Jeff Karzin discusses the second edition of his book about the Homer High School baseball team that set a national record for the longest winning streak in 2004 and 2005. But first, we look back at how Michigan became a right-to-work state. Mother Jones reporter Andy Kroll, a Portage Central High School graduate, joined us to discuss his story, Meet the New Kochs, the DeVos clan's plan to defund the left. The interview originally aired in February. Andy Kroll, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So could right-to-work have happened in Michigan without someone like Dick DeVos being able to provide the funding and lead the charge?
I don't see how that could be possible. As I sketch out in this story, right to work, you know, it was a pipe dream in the state of Michigan for decades, and it was always sort of this unattainable and frankly crazy notion, because Michigan is a very heavily unionized state compared to most of the rest of the country, cradle of the modern labor movement, the state that brought us the UAW. And so this idea was just sort of kicking around, and it was on a conservative wish list, if you will. But when you got Dick DeVos and his family, you know, this includes his very politically savvy wife, Betsy DeVos, he used to run the state Republican Party, and other family members. When he comes onto the scene and some of his allies in the mid-2000s and really starts thinking about how to potentially make this a reality and really starting to fundraise and talk about putting serious money behind it, this notion of right to work in Michigan goes from being crazy and a pipe dream to being something that actually had a chance. Still a long shot for really until the week or two before the bill passed, but I don't think without Dick DeVos and him, his money, his family's money, and his sort of political network would we be having this conversation.
But after Dick DeVos lost his bid for governor in 2006, he had some polling information from Bill McInturff, a regular contributor to NPR, as a matter of fact, often provides polling results there. And among the things they found was that there would be some pretty widespread support for a right-to-work law in Michigan. But they didn't jump on this right away. The timeline's kind of interesting. Were they sitting back waiting for the right moment, or was there a process going on in those intervening years?
Both. They get Bill McInturff to conduct this poll, and the numbers come back, and they seem to be favorable to an effort like right to work. And the key folks here, you know, Dick DeVos is one of them. I'd also note that former Ambassador Ron Weiser, who lives in Ann Arbor, major Republican fundraiser and operative, was also a big player as well. And I mentioned Ambassador Weiser in the piece. So the poll comes back, and they're intrigued. And so what they do is meet with a fellow named Frank Keating, who is now a big banking lobbyist in D.C. But Keating was the last Republican governor at the time. This is 2007, 2008. He was the last Republican governor at the time to pass a right-to-work bill in his state. And what he told Dick DeVos and Ron Weiser was that, you know, doing this via a ballot proposition, like so many of the ballot propositions you've seen in Michigan lately, was not a wise idea. And Keating told them that as a former Republican governor who presided over a right-to-work bill, you really want to have the legislature be a Republican, and you really want a Republican governor, because if you don't have a Republican governor, you have that veto there. So he gave them this piece of advice. You need to bide your time, and you need to basically take back the legislature entirely. And so they set about doing that. Ron Weiser, with Dick's help, becomes the head of the state Republican Party. And, you know, they invest money in the Mackinac Center, you know, a free market think tank that supports right to work. And then they start fully building the groundwork. and biding their time, you know, looking for the right moment. So it's a combination of those two things.
And was the right moment when some union activists getting a little nervous about the calls for right to work amongst perhaps a small but rather vocal number of state lawmakers decided to gather petition signatures and put a proposal on the ballot that more or less would guarantee collective bargaining rights in the Michigan Constitution? Was that the opening they were waiting for?
Yeah, that's what they say. That's what Dick DeVos and Ron Weiser and their political operatives say. You know, there's a chicken and egg situation here about what was the impetus for pushing right to work in the 2012 lame duck session, that little window of legislative activity between the November 2012 elections, you know, when the legislature changed over in January 2013. If you talk to DeVos and Weiser and those folks, they will say that Prop 2 going on the ballot was sort of the impetus, yes, for them to say, okay, this is the year we're going to do this. If you talk to Bob King at the UAW, you talk to the folks at the Michigan AFL-CIO, the MEA, and so forth, they believe that right to work was already on its way. They believe it was coming. They heard members of the legislature talking about it. They heard about Ron Weiser going around talking to people, you know, sharing this polling data that you and I just discussed and you know, sort of planting the seeds of, hey, you know, right to work could happen. So the unions believed there was right to work was a foregone conclusion and that they, as they put it to me, needed to launch a preemptive strike, which they believe Prop 2, had it passed, would have been. It would have preemptively sort of outlawed a right to work bill. And, of course, they failed. But there is a chicken and egg situation there because, you know, the unions say this thing was happening anyway. We need to get out ahead of it. And the conservative folks say, well, they did Prop 2, and then we decided to move. So it's hard to know which one is actually the case. I just, you know, report both. But that's a slightly murky part of this whole narrative.
But your reporting also shows that the unions didn't necessarily believe that the defeat of Prop 2 was going to lead directly to right to work, and they had assurances from many Republican lawmakers that it was a fight they weren't interested in. Governor Snyder was still saying at that time that it was not on his agenda. So what happened between Election Day 2012 and that day in December when Governor Rick Snyder signs that bill into law?
That window of time, maybe a six-week window, that's even less than that, it's a month-long window, is just an absolute frenzy of lobbying and discussions between the unions and the legislature and the governor's office and everything, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. There is a fascinating series of meetings between labor leaders in the state and representatives of the governor and representatives of the legislature furiously trying to work out a deal to take right to work off the table. And so you have concessions being offered. You have the Snyder administration putting forward ideas as if to say, well, if you labor folks and if you legislature would agree with these ideas, maybe we'll take right to work off the table. You know, a couple of those, these ideas didn't make it into my piece, but I found very interesting. Some of the ideas the Snyder administration put forward were changing selection of state Supreme Court judges from an election to an appointment process was one idea put out there. Abolishing the State Board of Education was another idea put out there, as was essentially gutting the State Civil Service Commission. So there are these big ideas being put out on the table, and ultimately the talks fell apart. The labor folks, the governor's representatives, the legislative leaders, the Senate Majority Leader, State House Speaker, they couldn't reach an agreement. And despite the assurances from some Republicans to the labor folks, this isn't right to work, it's not going to happen, it's too extreme. And just like that, the talks are over in late November, early December, in fact. And this process of putting the right to work bills out and voting on them and passing them is just fast-tracked. And before labor knows it, the bills have been passed in December, and Governor Snyder signs them on December 11th.
And your reporting also shows there were many Republican lawmakers who felt some serious pressure, even some Republican lawmakers who had decent ties with union members, who felt some real pressure to sign on to this legislation. What sort of things does it seem were held over their head?
Oh, I mean, they were. I had lawmakers talk to me about, you know, receiving phone calls from Dick DeVos or Dick DeVos's associates, definitely calls from former Ambassador Ron Weiser, a lot of lobbying going on by those folks, lawmaker telling me that he received essentially an implicit threat that if he didn't vote yes, he would be primaried. He would face a well-funded primary challenger when he runs for re-election, a Republican primary challenger. And so, you know, lawmakers, they felt the heat. They felt pressure to get on board. They realized that the folks on the conservative side who wanted this, the DeVos's, the Weisers, were sitting on top of a lot of money, and they could make their lives really miserable if they didn't. You know, I also report in the story, you know, the Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville feeling a lot of heat from wealthy donors who wanted this to happen, who wanted right to work to happen. He tells a union leader with the Carpenters Union that quote, "They've got my caucus. You can't imagine the pressure I'm under around right to work." And so, I mean, this was in that, both slightly before the November 2012 election, but especially in that lame duck window, the lawmakers felt the heat. Republican lawmakers felt the heat, especially the ones who were on the fence or maybe didn't support it. They were under a lot of pressure from some very well-financed people and organizations.
So is passing a right-to-work law in Michigan then seen as a blueprint for something that could be done in other states, perhaps many other states?
Yeah. Well, Michigan is the 24th state to be right-to-work, so there are 26 more to go. Or 26 more options. But yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, after the bill was signed by Governor Snyder on December 11th, 2012, you know, Dick DeVos kind of went on the road a little bit, as did some of the members of the legislature who were the biggest boosters of Right to Work. Dick DeVos gave a speech at the Heritage Foundation in early 2013, essentially laying out how they did it. It was very interesting because usually large donors like Dick DeVos don't step into the limelight and talk about, you know, how they did this. They prefer to operate in the background and let the results speak for themselves. But Dick DeVos went to Heritage Foundation here in D.C., a major conservative think tank, and laid out just how they did it, and with an eye toward instructing other folks how they could do it too. Later that fall, Dick DeVos spoke at, in September of 13, a conference of the State Policy Network, which is sort of an umbrella group for conservative think tanks around the country, basically Mackinac Centers in other states. This is the umbrella group for the Mackinac Center and its ilk around the country. And, you know, his line was, if we can do it in Michigan, you can do it anywhere. And he gave, you know, another version of the speech explaining how they pulled it off in Michigan. And then, this actually didn't make it into my story because I didn't realize this had happened, but a newsletter published by the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, as it's known, the sort of bill mill for the conservative side, put out a newsletter titled, "You Can Too!" exclamation point. And one of the sections of ALEC's "You Can Too!" newsletter was Michigan's right to work effort, and Dick DeVos featured very prominently in that section of the newsletter. And so, and it's very clear that the Michigan model is potentially being exported to other non-right to work states, where folks can try to, you put this into action. You know, State Senator Patrick Kolbeck, a Republican in Michigan, said he talked to folks in Illinois, Missouri, and New Hampshire, to name three states, about right to work and how Michigan pulled it off and how they could too. So, yeah, it's absolutely an effort possibly being replicated elsewhere.
I want to go back to something that's in the headline of your article. The DeVos clan's plan to defund the left. How does defunding the left work into all this?
The labor movement obviously dislikes right to work because they believe it allows workers, you know, in a unionized workplace, essentially to what they call freeload or free ride. They don't pay dues, but they can still benefit from, you know, a union negotiating a contract and that kind of stuff. Essentially, right to work, it's been shown in other states, bleeds the labor unions of their dues, of member dues, which is the lifeblood of their organization. It's their funding. It's how they pay for their programs. It's how they, in many ways, if the workers approve this, pay for politics. And so in states where right to work has passed and been in place for a while, you really see labor union participation drop, which means funding drops. And what that has to do with the left is that, you know, the unions for a very long time have been a pillar of support for democratic politics at the local level, at the state level, at the national level. It's still true today. You see labor unions, you know, at the national level, lending grassroots muscle to democratic politics, donating to political committees. Labor unions are a huge source of support for political parties, for progressives and democratic political parties. And if you bleed the unions of their dues, you essentially start to defund democratic politics and progressive politics. And this is a real threat for the left, if you will, and which is, you know, why they see right to work laws as toxic.
Andy Kroll, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Andy Kroll is a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine and a Portage Central High School graduate. The interview on his story, Meet the New Kochs, the DeVos Klan's Plan to Defund the Left, originally aired in February. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Between 2004 and 2006, the Homer High School baseball team won two state championships and set a national record for the longest winning streak. Jeff Karzen covered the team as a Battle Creek Enquirer sports writer and wrote the book Homer, The Small Town Baseball Odyssey. Karzen joined us from Chicago, where he now lives and works, to discuss the second edition of his book. The interview originally aired in January. Jeff, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Gordon. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back and remind everyone what made the Homer baseball story worthy of a book when it was published in 2008, the first time around.
Sure. First off, the on-field success that Homer garnered at that time was just incredible. To refresh people's memory, they, in a three-year span, they won two state titles. They only lost two games in that entire stretch. Take that back. I think it was by a combined three runs. It's been a little while since I brushed up on that one. But so they set the national record for consecutive wins with 75, which is just an astonishing feat when you think about the game of baseball, where every game you need a pitcher to perform and you need, you know, some clutch hitting sometimes and just kind of everything to click for 75 straight games is pretty amazing. So they did that, setting a national record and kind of putting their little town of 1,800 people on the national map with some of the attention they got around the country. And then in conjunction with that, after covering the baseball success for the Enquirer, I found out some things that really kind of made the story, I think, interesting to those that might not even be sports fans, in that the coach, Scott Sallow, who is still coach to this day, was nearly forced out of his job in the middle of all this when he wanted to go from a middle school teacher to the middle school principal. And there was kind of the old guard in town thought that you shouldn't be allowed to be a principal and a coach of one of their major sports because the time it requires to do both. And so he went through a lot of crazy stuff and emotional school board meetings and a lot of sleepless nights before finally being able to remain as coach.
So if someone has read the first edition of the book, maybe hasn't picked it up for a while, what are some things they might find in the second edition? What's some of the new material?
Sure. What I did with the second edition was a new final chapter. So updating readers on all the stuff the main characters have been up to in their post-high school lives. So a lot of it is on Josh Kalmenter, who I'm sure we'll spend some time talking about, is now with the Arizona Diamondbacks and recently signed a two-year contract to remain with Arizona. I spent a day with him and Homer in one of the recent off seasons and just kind of, you know, soaked in what his life is like now as going from a small town to pitching in front of 40,000 people on a regular basis now. So a lot is on Josh, and then as well as some of the other main characters from the book and Coach Salo and just updating people on all that's gone on since the book was printed initially in 2008.
Well, let's talk about Josh Kalmenter for a little bit. This is a guy who wondered if he was going to get a scholarship offer from a four-year uh-huh. university, and here he is now pitching for the Arizona Diamondbacks. How unlikely is that story?
Oh, it's a one-in-a-million kind of story, I think. As you said, he nearly ended up at Kellogg Community College because no Division I schools had offered him anything. And they wouldn't have unless the Homer team he was on as a senior, if they had been just the average kind of team, Josh would have ended up at Kellogg Community College. But because they were in big playoff games that attracted some college scouts and they got to see him pitch against some higher caliber competition, they were able to see what he's made of and that he's not just a small-town kid kind of picking on the other small towns, that he was able to match up and he threw his shutouts against some of the big schools like Blissfield and some of the storied programs in their class. So to go from that to now, I think one of the things I had mentioned in the new edition is kind of the list of the who's who of batters he's struck out in his short major league career. And it really is a who's who in the National League. It's, Matt Kemp and Ryan Braun and Prince Fielder. Just on and on and on, Troy Tulowitzki, and he belongs. He's not just a guy who got called up for a week and who knows what's going to happen, but he's in the major leagues to stay, and he's been there 3 years now, and he just got rewarded with a contract. He still doesn't have, a blazing fastball that is going to wow scouts, but the guy just knows how to pitch, and it's absolutely a once-in-a-lifetime is accurate, but once in a in a great long while kind of story to be able to come from his upbringing to where he is now.
And he's gone from being a starting pitcher and having a pretty good beginning to his career, his first season, struggling then and then converting to a reliever and finding success as a reliever. That's not often seen in Major League Baseball, is it?
No, yeah, that's true. He's a guy that was a starter his whole life until I think midway through his second season in the big leagues. And I admit, when I saw him struggling, I kind of had some thoughts of, uh-oh, they're catching up. They've seen what he's got. And one of his big advantages is his unusual over-the-top delivery, which kind of baffles hitters the first time around. But after the league had seen him, he struggled. And I thought, uh-oh, this might be it. But in true Josh Kalmenter fashion, he just kept working, and I'm sure he went into overdrive watching film, and he knows that he's not going to beat major league hitters on talent alone. He has to outthink them and outwork them, and that's exactly what he's done now to become a super successful reliever and a huge part of Arizona's bullpen.
You've been back in this area to do a book signing with Josh Kalmenter, and when you get out and talk to people, do you find that even 10 years after that first state championship, people are still interested in the story of Homer baseball?
They seem to be, and that's a rewarding thing for me to experience. It's pretty amazing that it's been 10 years already. Kind of time goes by, and you don't realize how long it's been. But yeah, getting a chance to do that book signing last week in Battle Creek with Josh Kalmenter, you know, it was interesting. It seemed like everyone that came to the signing had some sort of story about my grandson played against you on Concord, and, you know, I remember watching you play against Reading or whatever. So, yeah, it seems like it was just one of those moments in time for that area and for sports fans in this region that they're just never going to forget, you know, especially now that Kalmenter has made the major leagues. I'm sure the stories come up all the time now in family Christmases and Thanksgivings. I watched him play when he was in high school, and now he's on TV. So it's been a pretty cool thing to experience that 10 years later, it's something that people still care about.
As you say, a 75-game winning streak, which is what Homer had between 04 and 05, is a pretty remarkable run. Are you surprised that that record has since been broken?
That's a good question, Gordon. I guess a little bit, yeah. You know, it's a funny thing about records. When we look at this particular one, there was a school in New York, I believe the name was Archbishop Molloy, and they had it for something like 40 years, I believe. And then in the mid-2000s, a school from New Mexico got it. La Cueva, which you might remember me writing about a little bit. And then they only had it for a few months, and then they lost, and then Homer broke it. So it's just one of those things. You never know. So a school had it for 40 years, then another one had it for 2 months, and then Homer had it for, I don't know what it was, maybe... Six or 7 years, I think, right. So... You never know. I am a little surprised, to answer your question more directly. I am a little surprised that it was broken already. But what are you going to do? That's out of their control. When they lost, they opened the door, and who knows? Maybe the current school, I believe they're in New Hampshire, maybe they'll have it for another 40 years.
For people who maybe haven't followed Homer closely since then, is it still a strong baseball program?
Yeah, they are. I'm glad you asked that because they are. They had a couple down years where I was wondering to myself privately, is their run over? But then they've gotten back on the horse now, and they've put together some really impressive seasons lately. They went to the quarterfinals last year, and Scott Salo and his brother Tom are still in charge, and they do a great job. It still seems like it's one of those deals where the little kids in town still dream of putting on that orange jersey and being a Homer baseball player. So that's, you know, that's important to have that pipeline of it still being the thing to do in town. They're still strong. They're, of course, not dominant the way they were when the book came out, but they are certainly a healthy baseball program again, and winning 20-plus games a year on a regular basis.
Jeff, if someone's interested in the book, how can they find it?
Sure. The best place to go is www.homerbaseballbook.com. Really happy with the website and the way it turned out. I'd like to give a shout-out to the designer, who's actually a Kalamazoo native, Ken Campbell. He did a terrific job with the site, and I've gotten a lot of nice feedback on it. We just debuted it recently in the past 6 months or so. So it seems to be a nice resource for not only buying the book, but also kind of getting some information about what it's about and keeping up with Josh Kalmenter. We have a Kalmenter tab on the site as well. So I hope people will go there.
Jeff Karzin, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much, Gordon. It's great to talk to you.
Jeff Karzin is the author of Homer, the Small Town Baseball Odyssey, now in its second edition. In that interview, which originally aired in January, we mentioned Arizona Diamondbacks pitcher Josh Kalmenter. He has moved back to the starting rotation this season. So far, he has a record of 8 wins and 5 losses with a 4.07 ERA. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.